trailing the studies that you all are going through, so maybe you won't need an overhead because you'll know all about this already. This lesson is entitled Sin in the Camp, Jericho, Achan, and Ai. Those are familiar terms. Maybe they were before, certainly Jericho and Joshua are familiar terms. What I want to talk to you about tonight is the plan by which God moved Israel out of the mountains of Moab on the east side of the Jordan into the region of Canaan, up the side of the mountain traces, until finally they stood on the high ground. And then we'll learn some lessons that they had to learn in the midst of it. What was the strategy of God as he led the people? This is not the ideal map, but I think we can do it. You can see the Dead Sea down here. And here is where Israel was in the mountains of Moab. This region is actually higher in elevation than this over here, so that Moses was well able to stand over on Mount Pisgah and look across and see all the way up probably to Mount Hermon in the north. But the idea was to move into the low ground, and the fortress that was holding that fast was the fortress of Jericho. And they were not going to be able to move up the ascent of the mountain and onto the high mountain plateau unless they could conquer Jericho first. So they moved into a region named Gilgal, and I suspect that it was named that because they went there and camped in that place. And then they moved against Jericho, and then they went immediately up the side of the mountain to the high country and attacked the city of Ai. There is a story there, of course, and we want to talk about it. The Battle of Jericho, which you've already been talking about, not a little, in your studies. Jericho was not a large place. From archaeological digs, it's been determined that it wasn't any bigger than about 7 acres, and you can't have a lot of people within 7 acres. That'd make a good subdivision here, maybe. A small one here in Louisville. But its significance was not in the size of the city, but in the fact it was a very strong fortress city. So that it would have prevented the moving of Israel into that region. 10th day of the first month, and they've crossed the river. And it's in the flood time of the Jordan, and God, by his marvelous power, moves the waters back so they can cross over. And the water recedes just as soon as the feet of the high priest touches, the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant, touch the water. And then they stand in the middle of the dry bed of the Jordan. And while the people pass through onto the other side, the waters are held back. But Joshua told the people that they should choose a man from each tribe, 12 men, and that as each man passed where the feet of the priests were standing, they should pick up a stone. As a matter of fact, there was a series of 12 stones left right there where the priest stood. And every year when the Jordan receded, well, people could see those stones as a memorial. But stones were taken out of the bed of the Jordan and carried across, and they were set up at Gilgal. And they were set up there as a memorial to God's goodness and grace and power. Not only that, by the 14th day of the first month, you know what happened on the 14th day of the first month. Remember, that's the first month of the Jewish year, and on that very day, the feast of the Passover was eaten. You also know that as soon as they came into the land and ate the produce of the land of Canaan, just that soon, the manna stopped falling, and God's provision through the wilderness ended. They have remembered and set a memorial to the fact that God is the one who got them here. They have eaten the Passover feast, which reminds them of another time when God delivered them. And they have circumcised all that were not circumcised in the wilderness. They have sanctified themselves. Joshua was told by God to do that. Sanctify yourselves. You're going in to take the land. But God's plan to take Jericho was interesting. Gilgal wasn't far away from Jericho. It sits somewhat away from the River Jordan. You can stand in the city of Jericho today, and you can stand in the place where the old Jericho was, which doesn't appear to be very much if you want to talk about a place that looks like its glory has departed. Those digs certainly make it apparent. And you can stand and look across over the sycamore trees where a little fellow once climbed, and where there used to be, I think, more palm trees than there are today. It was called the City of Palms in the ancient time. This is where you went in the wintertime because it was warm down there when the weather was cold up in the mountains. And it was a resort city. But you have to look some distance to see the line of trees over there where the Jordan is flowing to the south into the Dead Sea. And very near, not too far away, the children of Israel camped, and they named the place Gilgal. I had a Bible teacher who thought of himself as being rather clever, who would always, in Old Testament history, ask some young lady where the children of Israel camped when they crossed the Jordan. And, of course, inevitably, they would not know. And he would say, Gilgal. There you have it. He wasn't very funny. And it didn't get much better than that in the course of the class. But the point is, it meant rolling. God has rolled away the curse of Egypt. God has rolled away that day of sorrow and sadness. And you've been brought into the land. And from this position, they were told they would go against the city of Jericho. Very unusual military strategy. Everybody of the men of war, not the rest of the people, the families stayed at home in the campsite at Gilgal. All the men of war were to march around the city once a day for 6 days. And you can see, if it's just 7 acres, that wasn't too big of a march. It wouldn't take them all that long to get the job done. And then on the seventh day, they were to march around 7 times. And when the seventh time was finished, there were 7 priests who were to blast on their ram horn trumpets a great sound. And then the people were to shout. And God said, the walls will come tumbling down. I want to notice with you that that required some considerable faith. How would you have reacted if you had anticipated with all these men of war that the way to attack that city was direct and to seize the stronghold of the enemy by some wise human strategy? But it was going to take a battle, obviously. And now you're told that all you're going to do is march around this city for a total of 13 times, and you thought that 13 was an unlucky number. 13 times, and then the walls would fall down of themselves. Of course, it'll be difficult to believe that unless you've just crossed the Jordan on dry land by the power of God. Unless you've lived to see God take care of you for 40 years in the wilderness wandering, water come out of rocks, manna out of heaven. And maybe, like Joshua, you remember the time when you crossed the Red Sea on dry land and escaped the armies of Pharaoh and saw them all drown in the sea. But they believe God. Faith is essential. And then, what it did was it glorified God rather than Israel. When they conquered the city, it was, what did we sing? To God be the glory, great things He had done. It didn't puff out the chest in Israel's army. It didn't make them feel like we've done some great thing. It was apparent from the beginning that this is the work of God. And it was an act of grace. You've read those words in the 6th chapter of Joshua. Now, Joshua was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given into your hand Jericho and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. I have given into your hand. Well, somebody could have said, I'm here, ready to receive it. We're here in the secure camp of Gilgal. Let's have it. Give us the key to the city so we can take possession. No, there's more to it than that. Grace does not eliminate faith. And faith includes works. And they did not receive the city which had been given to them until they acted in faith to obey. And did that rather ridiculous march by human standards and wisdom. So don't ever be set back on your heels because somebody said, salvation is by grace. You can't require anything of somebody who's saved by grace. Yes, you can. And God has done so. I have given. Grace is a gift that you don't deserve. And Israel didn't deserve it. There is no question. After their record in the wilderness, they didn't deserve much of anything. But God in His goodness gave to them, fulfilled the promise that He had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Grace can have conditions and not cancel grace. Grace can have conditions and not make it an act of work of righteousness. And if you want to remember this little text, you might use it the next time somebody begins to say to you, don't talk to me about baptism, because that would negate grace. No, it does not at all. It was an act of grace, but it required obedience. I think Joshua's faith in this particular case is remarkable, because when that trumpet had sounded, chapter 6, verse 16, Joshua said, shout, for God has given you the city. What God said, he believed, and prepared to accept it and announced it to the people. What is the application that we can make? Well, the first one is the one we've already alluded to, and that is when we call upon people to come and believe out of a penitent heart, a repenting spirit, and to be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sin, as the Bible demands. It's not something that came from me. Frankly, I wouldn't have been able to think of it. It wouldn't have entered into my mind to make such an arrangement. But God said that. The Lord Jesus said that. The apostles who came after Him, sent by Him, said that. And that's what we say. And it doesn't negate the fact that it was God who gave us everything. And we are saved by grace through faith. The second thing I wanted to observe is that in many ways we are still marching around Jericho. Because we haven't seen the walls fall. The world is wicked. Ungodly people seem to be having their way. They continue to prosper. And we have in our own hearts the same question that plagued the ancient psalmist, Psalm 37. Why do the wicked always prosper? I thought God, who is righteous, is in charge of this world. Well, you may have to march around Jericho a few years before the time comes for the walls to fall down. But you've got to have enough faith and enough dogged persistence that you're willing to do it. Some people don't have it. So they try it a little while, and if things don't go just as they had hoped, and just as quickly as they had hoped, they fall. So we take warning from that. Now, the city of Jericho had been accursed or devoted. Those two words are really close in the biblical language. A thing cursed and a thing devoted. In this particular case, it was devoted to God. Everything in it devoted to God. It was devoted in the sense that all precious things, the gold, the silver, the iron, and the brass, were to be taken and put into the treasury of God. Now, someone suggested, and I think it has some merit to it, that in a measure, these are the first fruits that belong to God. The first fruits of the conquest. The first booty taken. To whom does it belong? To God. That's always been the case in the nation of Israel. They brought the first fruits and offered it to God. The firstborn also were given to God. And so here, the first thing taken, the city of Jericho, it was devoted to the Lord. And it belonged to him, and everything else was to be destroyed. People, beasts, the city itself burned with fire. And that is exactly what took place. The only pause was for those two young spies who had made a promise to Rahab to go into that city and bring out the residents of her house, Rahab and her family, and to deliver them. And The vessels of silver and gold and brass and iron were saved and put into the treasury of God. And then the city was cursed.
Joshua said that whoever rebuilds the foundation of the city will do so with the death of his firstborn. And whoever sets up the gates will do so with the death of his youngest child.
If you want to read about the fulfillment of that, you read 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings 16 and verse 34, because that's exactly what happened when the city of Jericho was rebuilt later. Now we're going to talk about Achan's sin. Chapter 7 begins with an adversity.
But great victory in chapter 6, city of Jericho overwhelmed by the power of God alone.
And the people walked straight in ahead of themselves into the city. The men of war walked straight in and take the city. But, says chapter 7, the children of Israel committed a trespass in the devoted thing. But the children of Israel. That's a little challenging, isn't it?
We understand from this story that it's one man. Maybe his family in complicity. One man. But this text says, but Israel committed a trespass. Maybe the Holy Spirit, by stating it this way, is intending to say that when one member of the family violates the will of God, it involves in its consequences all members of the family. Anyway, that is what's revealed as the story unfolds.
What are they doing here? Let me get back over to the map.
What they're going to do, as God has arranged it, is they've come in, they've taken this fortress city down here at Jericho. Now they're going to move up the side of the mountain to one of those water traces that are created because it rains on the top of the mountain. Down here it's awfully dry. It's the most barren place I've ever seen in my life. But the rains that come in the heights of the mountain flow down the side of the mountain and water at periods of time the east side of the mountains. I've often said that if it weren't for the strategic value of that east side of the mountains, the Israelis, I'd give it all there right now because it didn't look like there's anything there you could do with it. But there it is. And they're going to move up here in a wedge, you see, and they're going to move against Ai because Ai is up there a little over 10 miles north of Jerusalem. Very near to Bethel. You remember Bethel? The house of God.
You remember Jacob? Flying
away from his brother's wrath, going over to his wife's or to his mother's people in Padan Aram, and he sleeps the night there and he puts his head on a stone and he has a vision of God and angels ascending and descending on a ladder. And he called it the house of God, Beth El. And that's the place very nearby to this city. And of course by this time pagan people have inhabited Bethel. Pagan people in Ai. I don't know how big a fortress city it was. I don't suspect it was nearly as large as Jericho. The most important city has fallen, and now they're going to take this other one.
And when they get that done, there's going to be a wedge opened up. And then they'll move to the south, and they'll move to the north, and they'll take this whole territory.
Because they're on the high ground. It's important to be on the high ground. If you're going to conquer, you're going to have to stay on the high ground. People in the high ground have the advantage. And that's absolutely true morally. You're not going to conquer anything. You're not going to achieve anything starting on the low ground. We think we can. Playing tricks. Shaving a few corners. Doing things that are expedient because we need to do that in order to achieve the end. But let me tell you, no great end is ever achieved by any method that is dishonorable. And you're corrupted in the process. So they get up on the high ground, or they try to. By this time, you can imagine the psychological state of Israel. Confident. They are absolutely, swellingly confident. They saw Jericho fall flat. And this is a smaller place. So the spies go up and look at Ai, and they come back saying, well, yes, you know, don't trouble yourselves about this. 2,000 or 3,000 will do it easily. So 3,000 men went up to Ai, and 3,000 men came running back. Because the people of Ai absolutely drove them out like a flock of sheep.
And when they got through running in the face of the enemy, 36 men were dead, and maybe 36 families followed us. Joshua was dismayed. Chapter 7, verse 6. He tore his clothes, which was an expression of anguish and sorrow in the nation, and fell to the ground upon his face before the ark of the Lord until evening. He is deeply grieved. He is hurt. He is distressed. He is despondent. They had begun so marvelously. He had such confidence and faith. And now suddenly this move into the land of Canaan that looked like it was going just very easily is stopped dead still, and they have a crushing defeat. And Joshua does not understand why, and he says, "Alas, O Lord," in verse 7, "wherefore have you at all brought this people over the Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites, to cause us to perish?" Does that sound like the children of Israel in the wilderness? "Moses, have you brought us out here to die? Weren't there enough graveyards in Egypt? We could have died there." There is a little hint of that in these words. "Would that we had been content and dwelt beyond the Jordan." I wish that we had just stayed back over on the other side of the Jordan. "Oh Lord, what shall I say after that Israel had turned their backs before their enemies? How can I, as the general of this army, how can I even face these men? Because I've sent those men up there and they've just been sent out flying. And they went by your instruction." He felt a bit betrayed, I think. "For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will compass us round and cut off your name from the earth, and our name from the earth, and what will you do for your great name?" Well, it's good that Joshua was concerned about the name of God and about what was going to happen to the people, but he was mistaken, of course, in his judgment that God had somehow failed. And now he learns, as God speaks to him in plain language, and the Lord said to Joshua, "Get up. Why are you thus fallen upon your face? Israel has sinned. Yes, they have even transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. Yes, they have even taken of the devoted thing and have also stolen and dissembled also, and they have even put it among their own stuff." Now, look at the charge. They have violated the covenant because they have stolen. Stolen from whom? Stolen from the people of Jericho? No. Stolen from God. They took of that which was devoted to the Lord. And then the second charge, and we don't have any detail about this, they acted otherwise. They played a game. They dissembled. They played the hypocrite here in acting as though they had not done it. I don't know what the details of that may be. But God charges them with it. "Therefore, the children of Israel cannot stand before the enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies because they have become accursed. I will not be with you anymore except you destroy the devoted thing from among you." Why did they succeed in the first place against Jericho? Because God was with them. Why did they fail at Ai? Because God was not. What's the secret here? God. Not the strength that you possess, not the wisdom you possess, but being with God. And there's an important principle there. That it doesn't make any difference how well you plan, how ably you undertake it. If God is not with you, it's going to fail. And it doesn't make any difference how weak you are and how inadequate you are. If God is with you and if you're working with Him and according to His will and submitting yourself to Him, you're going to succeed. There's a principle there, without any doubt. Achan had sinned, and his sin found him out. It's an interesting procedure. I'm not sure we could reenact this, but I get the impression that maybe they cast lots or something of that sort. God said, "You bring all the tribes before you, and then you cast lots or do something, and the tribe on which the lot falls, that's the tribe where the guilty party is. And then you bring that tribe and you let all the families of that tribe come before you, and then you cast lots to do whatever you might do. And then the one that the lot falls on of the families, that's the family where the guilty party is. And then you take that family and let all the individual
household of that family come before you. And then when the lot falls upon that household, then you let each individual in that household come before you. And the one the lot falls on, that's the man who went through that whole process naked. There, stark naked, morally and spiritually, because he was caught. And Joshua just tells him in a fatherly tone, son, just confess what you've done. You just need to address this matter directly and say what you have done.
And Achan said what he had done.
And Achan knew it was wrong. It had already been said in plain language by Joshua, the voice of God giving this instruction, that everything in that city was devoted to God. This is not like taking it from a man. It's worse than that. It's taking what belongs to God.
But he did it anyway. Why? Because he saw it.
And he desired it.
200 shekels of silver, 50 shekels of gold,
and a Babylonish garment, I think some versions have, or a mantle of Shinar. Was that Babylon, Shinar, the Chaldeans, all refer to the same region of the world.
And there are two things in this man's sin.
First of all, just money. I mean, you can do a lot with
200 shekels of silver and 50 shekels of gold. It would have made him a wealthy man.
And there's a thought of having something. But this garment, which came from Chaldea, which came from Babylon, which although in that time had lost some of its earlier glory and was waiting for its newfound glory under Nebuchadnezzar to arrive, was still a pace setter in that ancient world. And what they did in Babylon was thought of as being it. It. We've got people today that want to do the thing that makes them it. They want to do the thing and wear the clothes that puts them into the picture.
And so Achan fell not only to simple covetous greed, but also a desire to be somebody by the style and the cut of his clothes. And he pulled that garment out and that silver and that gold
and thought nobody saw him. Wasn't that a mistake? Thought nobody knew. Thought he could get away with this. And we think we can get away with it because we pulled some stunts that we know when we do them are wrong.
We're not ignorant. We're not naive.
We know we're dancing on the thin edge of disaster. We understand that we are kind of walking on the edge of the precipice. But we justify ourselves by saying it's not all that bad.
Listen, if it's going the wrong direction for a Christian to be going, it's bad. That's not the right attitude for any child of God
who moves not toward and as close as he can get to what is wrong, but away from it.
But it's marvelous that he thought he
would escape. But let me tell you, he's not any stranger than we are, because we think we can do it. We're going to escape too. Because nobody knows about it. And so we just hold our heads up high and go along like we're just doing everything fine.
The only trouble is, God knows. And before it's over, so will everybody else. He stole from God. 36 men are dead because of his presumption. It's not just
Achan that'll suffer here and his family, his immediate family, but a lot of other families going to suffer. And we've got to understand something. I'm going to stress this as well as I'm able here tonight. And that is, as Christians, we are tied together. We are tied together. You can't do anything that won't somehow influence or affect my life. I'm sorry, that's what a family is about. And I can't do anything that will not either affect for the good or for ill your life. Here I am up here preaching and teaching. If I go out and do some fool thing, even though it's not widely known among the brethren, do you think there are not people out there saying, look at that? That man claims to be a preacher of righteousness, and he acts like that? What kind of people would have a man preach to them who does that?
And you can't blame them. And it goes for all of us. Because if you're a member of a family and you do something that's bad, it casts a reflection and puts a burden on everybody in the family. Can you imagine the hurt of families that have children do some horrendous wrong, kill a bunch of people? What those mothers and fathers have to endure as a consequence of that? I'm not suggesting to you that sometimes the burden doesn't lie on them because of their neglect sometimes, but I can imagine that there are cases where it is not, and they are so brokenhearted and reach out somehow to try to save the people who have been so critically injured by all this. We're sorry. If there's anything we could do, we'd undo all this.
Painful.
And they took Achan after his confession, and not only that, to demonstrate that every word must be secure, they didn't even take his confession as final evidence. They went to the tent and dug up the evidence and brought it out. And then Joshua said, now, here's a good question for you. Was Achan lost eternally? I don't know. Is there a possibility that he was penitent here? It's possible that he was. Is there a possibility that God would be merciful to him? It's possible. It's unstated. I don't know. But the consequence of his sin came. It's what the law said. And the children of Israel as a whole took up stones and stoned Achan and his family to death and burned them with fire. And all that appertained to them, all their possessions, were destroyed. Now, I don't know if the family of Achan were guilty of concealing the matter that the father had been guilty of. Leviticus 5, verse 1 says, if you do that, you become responsible because you don't tell it. You don't reprove. You don't try to get the thing correct. But that may not be the case. The truth is that what we do that's wrong often brings sadness on our children, even those that are not responsible in any way. There is a connection between human beings. We don't live in an island, on an island. We don't live by ourselves. There's a connection between human beings, and what we do affects others. And there's no way to cut that chain and say, it's my business. If I do it, it's none of your business. Yes, it is. Because you have influence and the consequence of your deeds lives to burden others. But Achan was mistaken because sin always reveals itself. And I want to tell you the truth. You sin and it'll always show in you. Sin doesn't work. And dissembling about it, covering it up, or doing it on the sly, or doing it here, doing it there, some other place where you think other brethren will not know anything about it, will not achieve anything in terms of a cover-up for you, because sooner or later it become evident that's the case. It'll have its impact in your life. First of all, it'll strike you in your conscience. And if you try to deaden your conscience, it will cause you to do some other things that you ought not to be doing, because you're beginning to separate yourself and distance yourself from the influence of your Father and of your Redeemer. And secondly, it'll always have a consequence to others. Everything that you and I do in this congregation that is wrong works to have and to create a burden for other Christians. What happened in this case is when they went up against Ai, they failed. And they failed because there was sin in the camp. The only way we're going to be victorious as a group of people over our enemies and be able to achieve what God wants us to achieve and the salvation of the souls of others is if we keep sin out of the camp. We can't play a game. People detect the contradictions. And even if they don't say anything about it, they will observe it. And they'll say something about it to other people. And so shame comes upon us as a consequence of that. You know what's interesting?
is that when God did send the army of Israel up against Ai the second time, all of them had a good plan. An ambush. Put the part of the army on the west side and part on the north side, and then Joshua and his men, some of the men came up and confronted them, and they came out of that fortress running after Joshua. And of course, because that's what had happened before, Joshua just took off running, and they took off running after him. And what they didn't realize was there were other troops that were stationed to come out and take the city while all those fellows had left town. And they did, and when they looked back and saw the smoke rising, they knew they had been had. And then Joshua and his army, the rest of the army, took off after them, and they utterly destroyed that city. 12,000 people died. You know what? Achan could have had what he stole, because in Ai, they were allowed to take the booty. Animals and other things. They were allowed to have it for themselves. I don't know how large a principle there is here, but this one I think we can say. If we will patiently wait for God to provide what we need, instead of seizing it contrary to His will, and that involves things or whatever else it may be, a relationship, we'll finally have it with God's blessing. He'll fill our lives full. But if we just decide we can't wait for that, we're going to have it now, and we subject ourselves to temptation, and we yield to that temptation, and we seize what is contrary to God's will, then the consequence will come, and it'll be a sad one. If you'll just trust Him and wait, you'll have all the good things that God wills to give you. May not be money, but that, as we said this morning, is not the best thing anyway, of all the treasures. What can we say about application of these things? New Testament period, anything here for us? Yes, 1 Corinthians 10:6. Lust after things as they did. Perished. These things are written for our learning. 1 Corinthians 10:11. It's possible for sin to exist in a church and be hidden from the elders. It is possible. And I think sometimes some of those things remain hidden for a time. But that, of course, does not justify toleration of known sin in the camp. God said to Joshua, get up off your face and let's deal with the problem. Sin in the church often affects others who stumble and fall because of that influence. Think about it. It's not just the wrong you have done, but others looking at you and admiring you will follow you in that direction. When sin is in a congregation, it's a time not merely for prayer. I think it's always a time for prayer. And Joshua was praying. He didn't understand what was going on, but he was praying to God. He was addressing God. But it's a time for action, too. Number four, the church can only stand against her enemies when she lives up to the profession that she makes. 2 Samuel 12, verses 9 and 14, when David sinned with Bathsheba, Nathan said, you have given great occasion to the enemies of God to blaspheme. This hurts. Romans 2 and verse 24. Where the apostle addresses some of the hypocrisies of the Jews who made such a thing out of their devotion to God and to His law and the fact that they had the law of God as their own in the covenant. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Well, I think that's enough for tonight. Pretty good lesson here, though, isn't it? Sobering. We want the church at Douglas Hills to go forward in a godly way and to achieve good things in the lives of other people, salvation, transformation, people made more and more like God and Christ. We have so many to be concerned about. We have young Christians who are so tender. And we want them to have an example from us that says to them, you can do the will of God. You can be faithful. You can be steadfast, even in difficult times, even when the temptations are strong. They need to look at you and to see you strong in the face of those temptations. So much good work to do.
when one of us proposes to do what is wrong, it will have its effect. I believe we all care. I think even the ones of us who stumble every now and then. And maybe we stumble and stay down a while. I don't doubt that we care. And I want to increase that concern in you. And I want to call upon you in love and deep interest to do what you need to do, and that is confess the wrong and clean it up. And when we can get that out of our lives, I can get it out of my life, you can get it out of your life, we can all go along together and accomplish some great things by His power, by the power of God. You know the situation as it is. I don't always know. Some people think when I'm preaching on things like this, I got somebody in mind and I'm going after them, but that's not always true. But the Lord knows, and He's the one you got to face at last, and He's the one that decides whether we succeed or fail. So let's deal with Him tonight. He loves you. He wants you to succeed. He believes in you. He's invested His Son in you, and you've come to follow Him. Now, really do that by correcting courses that need to be corrected. The invitation of Christ is always present while time stands. He looks out longingly, come to me, all you that labor and heavy laden. He looks out to those who are Christians and calls upon them to come and receive the benefits of his intercession. For He makes intercession for the saints, always lives to do that. Says Hebrews chapter 7. Won't you come tonight if you need to? If you're not a Christian, confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized into Him. If as a Christian you need to clean up something that's standing there as a problem, do that while we're standing and encouraging you with the words of this hymn.